call this meeting to order. Of the House Resources Committee at the time is 8:11 a.m. March 12th. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Williams?
Here.
Representative Hudson?
Here.
Representative Bundy?
Here.
Representative Carney? Representative Davies?
Here.
Representative Finkelstein? Representative Green?
Here.
Representative Ames? Representative Mulder?
We have a quorum present. We will begin today but with a briefing by the Water and Wastewater Works Advisory Board. This group is here to explain their functions and duties, the role they play with DEC and how they can be used as a resource.
Good morning.
Since we go on teleconference at 8:30 for our hearing on mental health lands bill, we need to try to conclude this presentation by 8:30. Will the members please state your name for the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be out of here by 8:30. My name is Ernie Muller. I'm a member of the Water and Wastewater Works Advisory Board, and with me today is John Hargesheimer of Fairbanks, who is a member of the board, and Jim Berg of Anchorage, who is also a member of the board. And we appreciate the opportunity to come to you and tell a little bit about who the board is and what we do, and why we think the work that we do for the Department of Environmental Conservation is important. The board and the staff has put together a little briefing paper for you that talks a little bit about some of the critical issues that we've been involved with. I should explain to you that the board is 9 members appointed by the governor. The back page has who we are and how you can get a hold of us in case there's an issue that you think would be of interest to us or somewhere we could help you out. Our principal role is to advise the Department of Environmental Conservation on water and wastewater works operators, operator training, requirements for operators throughout the state. We also work with them on other things. Some of the members of the board worked on the development of the drinking water regulations that the state is now going through a complicated adoption policy. And we've also worked with them on wastewater disposal regulations. The principal reason for our work, Mr. Chairman, is to reflect the fact that the state and federal governments and local governments in Alaska over the last 10 years have probably spent about $1.5 billion in water and wastewater facilities throughout the state. And on the first page of our little report, it explains where the money that was expended by the state, some 800, now that my glasses, I can't read it. What happens when you get gray hair? Some $628 million that the state has provided over the last 10 or 11 years, and some almost $300 million that the federal government has provided in the last 10 or 11 years. In facilities funding throughout Alaska. And we believe, and I think the facts bear us out, that unless those facilities are properly operated and properly maintained, that money is not going to be well protected and that investment is going to be lost. So our job is to help DEC largely develop requirements for who those operators are, set standards for them, help them develop examinations to ensure that these people are qualified, help review operator complaints in case they have complaints against the Department of Environmental Conservation, and help set standards for the general classification and operation of these facilities. The state over the last few years has done a lot in terms of expanding its work on assisting operators. Particularly, our concern, however, in part, if you look on the back page, is that there's very little money that's spent by the state in training these operators. And those of us who work in urban communities like mine, I work here in Juneau, the community has some resources and oftentimes can provide training to its operators, but in small rural communities and throughout Alaska, particularly those communities that don't have a large economic base, it's very difficult for them to have the resources to train those operators. So a lot of that training is provided by the state, and a lot of the supervision of those systems is provided by the state through what's known as the Remote Maintenance Worker Program. Those people are people who travel in the rural areas to these small communities and help them keep their water and wastewater systems operating. We're very concerned that that program continue and, if possible, expand, because we're not only dealing with protecting an investment here, we're also dealing with basic public health issues, particularly safe drinking water and proper waste disposal. I was in Texas when the great Colonia debate started last year, and I know what they're talking about down there in terms of dealing with areas that are that have no proper water and waste disposal, and I know that a lot of the rural communities in Alaska are no better off than they are there. And the federal government spent a lot of money down there, and they're not spending as much money as needed in Alaska to bring some of these rural communities up to where they really need to be in terms of protecting their residents' health and properly disposing of waste. So one of the big concerns that we have now is, and we had for years, how do we help these rural communities get the kind of water and wastewater systems they need, and how do we keep them operating, knowing that for many of them, the economics of that operation is real, real difficult without a lot of state assistance. Do you guys have any?
No, I think you covered it well.
If you have any questions, we'd be happy
to have some.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed in your charts that for the state funding, there is, other than a couple of the last spending years before the economy kind of took a turn, a fairly modest sum until the last 2 years, and that kind of offset by 93's federal expenditure that is about one-third. What causes these wild fluctuations?
In state spending?
Well, in both. It seems like the federal spending is a lot more consistent until this last year, but state spending has been all over the map.
I think that's reflective of two things. One of them is the amount of state money that you have for capital money.
I see.
And probably the commitment of the state towards these kinds of facilities, which is reflected a lot in an understanding of what the needs are and how that is, that stacks up against other capital priorities, roads, schools, whatever.
Well, could I follow that up? What do you anticipate, say, for 94 or 95 as far as the state comes?
I think maybe the legislature has a better answer to that than we would. Because a lot of this funding comes directly out of the...
You're saying you can spend as much as you can get.
That's been the history.
There's been more needs than there are dollars.
That's been
the tradition.
Well, if I could follow, just one more question. You show training fairly flat, and I'm covering about six subjects at once, but is it true that both water and wastewater systems in the rural areas have had a problem with proper maintenance?
Yeah, and there's really a couple of solutions to that. I think that training operators, making sure that they're paid a reasonable amount for the work that they do is critical. The other thing that seems to work very well is this remote maintenance worker program, where somebody who really knows systems and how to run and maintain a water and wastewater system travels around, inspects the system, helps the operator, shows them what to do, does a little over-the-shoulder, on-the-job kind of training, and it seems to be real effective.
It does two things. One, it creates an incentive in the small village, because you're this individual that comes into town, makes the guy feel good, answers his questions, responds to his concerns, and in addition, it spreads the cost of having a highly qualified individual moving and not just staying in one place and being able to cover the issues in more than one community. So it's been quite effective.
The cost savings relative to the success of the remote maintenance worker program have been documented. Were, I think, prior to the installation of that program in the state, we were seeing about one system failure per year, had a net cost the state of about $1 million per incident. And since that program has been in there, not only have we seen where the remote maintenance worker is taking an active part, we're seeing a better public health protection there. We have a dysentery problem, some other problems in the bush. we're seeing less of that, but also less of the capital system failures. And the net capital offset to the state is documentable at times.
So you think you've got a handle on those problems? Because that's where my next question is going with it. We're seeing an outbreak of a lot of medical problems associated with improper treatment or failed systems. And so you think through this training program, you've got a handle on that now, and if systems were to be brought back up to spec, that they could be maintained and wouldn't fail because of neglect or improper training or whatever the reason.
Well, I think our general feeling is that more dollars could go into training and certification. It's currently being discussed by the Finance Committee, actual cuts in the training budget. So, you know, there's a little bit of a feeling that we're going in the wrong direction. I mean, when you're discussing cuts, you're not discussing putting money back, putting additional money in.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the remote maintenance worker and some of the other programs, there's a grant out right now to consider privatization of a number of village safe water systems in the Nana Corporation area. This is another tool that can be used to eliminate future state expenditures. Not all these things work in every location. I don't believe that we're saying that the remote maintenance worker program is adequate in solving all the problems. I think that the budget cuts that are being impacted throughout the Department of Environmental Conservation, as well as in the training and certification issues. I think as a result of those, if those are implemented, I think you're going to see more medical issues, more system failures.
My understanding right now is that there is a hepatitis outbreak in some of the rural communities that is directly associated with sanitation. And sanitation means a lot of things, but a major thing that it means is proper human waste disposal and proper drinking water protection. Once we've got those things nailed down and they're operated safely, then we can deal with some of the other sanitation issues. But without that, we can't deal with the other sanitation issues.
I might add, too, with the success of the remote maintenance worker program, DEC staff had targeted several areas for additional remote maintenance workers where they felt that this program was such a success that these regions could also be incorporated successfully. Kodiak, the villages around Kodiak Island were immediately targeted, and then some of the villages around the Bethel area. And there was plans at one time, depending upon funding limitations, to expand the remote maintenance worker program because of the successes that they have felt that they have had to date.
How many remote maintenance workers are there?
Six.
How many areas are there? Well, not a whole lot. The entire budget, I think, is under 800,000.
Mr. Representative Hudson,
Ernie, you've probably been following the budget, and the operating budget, of course, is being decreased, or at least being proposed for decrease. And we, in the Labor and Commerce Committee, hustled along House Bill 65, which converted to user fees to try to cover many of the services that are needed here. And that bill sits in State Affairs at the moment, and my way of thinking was pretty essential if we're going to continue to provide the kind of oversight and professional assistance we need to manage both commercial, industrial, as well as you know, private inspections. Are you aware of what's being done on the budget side this year? I might have missed that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We had a briefing yesterday from Janice Adair. I guess from our perspective, I think that just like the Public Utilities Commission is funded now largely through fees that the regulated utilities pump in, that those of us who are permittees from DEC ought to be paying our fair share so that we're not getting that.
So you do support House Bill 65?
I would, yeah.
Use that element of it. I hope that this committee recognizes that that's an important element of continuing this important service.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming here and
thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Well, they said they'd be here and they were. For the record, Representative Finkelstein is here. We will not go on teleconference. I'll go through this prior to the time that before Attorney General Cole gets there. We will now go on teleconference so members remember to use the microphone. The sites we have with us today are Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Matsu. We are taking up House Bill 201 today. This bill was sponsored by this committee and was introduced last week. Before deciding to introduce this bill, this committee had two overview hearings on mental health land settlement and heard testimony regarding the history and issues surrounding the mental health testimony. Mental health trust land settlement from a number of key players, including Attorney General, attorneys for settling and non-settling, mental health plaintiffs, and representatives of mining, oil, and environmental interests who have intervened in the land settlement case. After those hearings, this committee formed a subcommittee to formulate the proposed approach for this committee to use in detailing this issue. That subcommittee and the full committee eventually concluded that the language in House Bill 201 was what we wanted to introduce and take up as a starting point for discussions aimed at seeking a solution to the mental health settlement. Since we have already had considerable background testimony, I would like for today's testimony to be focused on the actual bill before us, the approach that proposes the specific provisions of this legislation. Besides Attorney General Charlie Cole, it is my understanding we will hear prepared testimony today from Bob Stiles, President of Alaska Coal Association, Tom Waldo, Attorney for Public Interest Intervening, Jeff Jesse, Attorney with the Advocacy Service of Alaska, one of the mental health groups, which has drawn from settlement funds. Peter Gasson, attorney for North Carolina Marathon Oil, and David Walker, attorney for settling mental health plaintiffs. In addition, we have Tom Custer in the audience, please. And Brian Borkus, the name.
No, not a chance.
Who are both with the Attorney General's office and other people in the audience both here and on teleconference who may want to add comments and who would be available to respond to questions. We will start with Attorney General Charlie Cole. He should be here shortly. He does have another meeting to attend, so I want to get prepared before he gets here. He will be here with us for about 15 or 15 minutes. So we will stand at ease until Charlie gets here. Yeah. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Cole. We are on teleconference with Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Matsu. So if you could use a microphone, and if you have any comments or
comments on the night show.
Pardon me, sir.
I just ignore.
Keep them nice.
Okay.
Let me make a preliminary statement, if you will. Under the terms of the settlement agreement entered into between lead counsel for plaintiffs Weiss and those similarly situated, as well as the attorney for the Alaska Mental Health Association and others, Mr. Walker and Mr. Gottstein, as well as signatory to that agreement, Jeffrey L. Jesse, attorney for individual intervening plaintiffs. If the court denied a motion, or if an order approving the motion for cancellation of the renotice of list pendants and for modification to remove the preliminary injunction, more particularly described earlier in the agreement, was not entered into or entered by the court within 4 months of the date the motion is submitted to the court for decision, the party shall have 60 days to arrive at a mutually agreeable way to address the interests of the third parties and the trust in the parcels of the original lands. Let me see if I can state that slightly less legally. You will recall there was the injunction precluding the state from issuing deeds to the so-called moms and pops. And the state was concerned about that and wanted to afford relief to those people. As I testified earlier, those people are innocent. They dealt with the state in good faith. Paid money, and now by virtue of the order of the Superior Court in Fairbanks, the state cannot perform. So we sought to afford relief to those people by, in effect, pledging the full faith and credit of the state to protect the plaintiffs. And we provided that if such relief was not granted, the party shall have 60 days to see if we could figure out a way to give appropriate relief to these people. And we further provided, however, quote, in the event the parties are unable to arrive at such an agreement, either party may terminate this settlement agreement. An application for relief for the moms and pops was made to the Superior Court in Fairbanks, and the Superior Court denied that motion on the ground that the propriety of granting it was directly related to the validity of Chapter 66. So the court did not grant that relief. That is, the relief sought by this motion to, in essence, protect the interests of the moms and pops was not granted. So, in a further effort to grant relief to those people, the state petitioned the Alaska Supreme Court asking it to review the order of the Superior Court denying the relief to the moms and pops sought by the motion. As part of that petition, the state asked the Supreme Court to give us all a little help in explaining the scope of the set-off, which it granted to the state in the original Weiss decision. You will recall I've previously spoken about the ambiguities in the opinion on that issue. Yesterday, the Supreme Court, without comment, denied the petition. We are currently reflecting on what action, if any, the state should take in light of that rejection by the Supreme Court and denial of order for relief by the Superior Court. Because relief to these innocent third parties was one of the administration's major objectives. The formulation of Chapter 66. So much for that subject. Now passing on to the subject issue. My view, and the administration's view, has been that the breach by the state of its obligations under the Mental Health Enabling Act should be resolved on the basis of the merits of that claim, and that the Weiss litigation should not be used as a vehicle to permanently obtain an mental health appropriation. So long as the mental health claimants, and I use that term generically, are guaranteed by statute 6% of unrestricted general revenues, it is difficult to achieve a settlement which, in my view, satisfactorily resolves the issues surrounding the Weiss claim. If you have pending litigation or a statute in existence which says 6%, I mean, there is not, in my view, great incentive to wrap up the issues. For example, as a result of the BP settlement and the Phillips settlement, $660 million, whatever, pardon me?
680,
thank you. Arithmetic is poor. I mean, additionally goes to the mental health. That's what I call a windfall. So, with those first comments, I conclude my remarks.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Green? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do I understand that if a settlement is reached that includes a percentage of the revenue to the state as part of that settlement, that we will not have put to rest, and if all parties agree to that, that we will not have put to rest the issue, and that, as you indicated, additional windfalls might then still be dedicated? I mean, that the litigants can't come to an agreement without exchange of property, that cash can't be used? Or did I misunderstand you?
No, cash, of course, can be used. No question, if all parties agree, cash can be used. What I'm simply sort of saying is that that 6% figure presently generates $140 million a year. When additional tax settlements are entered into, and under those settlements, money properly goes into the general fund, well, of course, the 6% factor applies to them. That's all I'm saying.
I see what you're saying.
I mean, if that's the legislative's intent, the legislature's intent, well, that's all well and good.
If I may follow, just quickly, sir. Thank you. You're probably aware that there is a companion set up for a piece of legislation that the House has introduced that would be lower than 6%, so that may still be a negotiable item there. Okay.
Yes, I was obliquely referring to the 3%. Certainly, if you think about the position of the Weiss claimants, 3% is less satisfactory than 6%.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. For the record, Representative James was here about 20 minutes ago. Representative Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General. I want to explore your comment just a little bit further, just so I understand exactly what your position is. If I understand what you said, it's following up the comment that I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Following on the comment that Representative Green made, that your view is that any kind of permanent appropriation as a percentage of the general fund would be inappropriate because it doesn't meet the merits of the original case, of the original settlement, the original breach.
Could I just...
Sure, but want to rephrase that for me?
No, that's fine. It does not isolate the merits of the Weiss claims and what should be paid to settle them from a perpetual appropriation to mental health.
Okay, well, that's what I want to talk about. If under an alternate scenario of solution, the entire corpus of the land, something approaching, well, the entire, we can't reconstitute the whole thing. What would be inappropriate in substituting for that portion that wasn't reconstituted a permanent percentage of the general fund from the point, and I'm coming from the point of view that the land itself, I think under the original congressional intent, was intended to provide essentially a permanent income stream?
The answer to the question, well, I almost had an answer, but until you added that qualification, I thought I had the answer. But I do not believe that the intent of the original Enabling Act was to provide a permanent fixed stream. I think the intent of that was to make available available lands from which income could be generated to support in whole or in part, depending upon the legislature's desires, the mental health program. Now, answering your question before that last qualification was added, nothing would be wrong with that so long as the total dollars paid to make good the state's obligations under the Enabling Act is fairly keyed to the damages sustained by the trust for the state's breach.
May I follow up on that particular
comment? Could I mention the time? How much time do you have?
Well, I would like to respond to the questions because it is an important issue, but a few more minutes.
Okay. We do have a couple other people that would like to ask some questions. Representative James.
Yes, Mr. District.
I've been called worse.
That's another radio show.
Just one comment on some of your previous testimony regarding the $680 million that we have. And I guess you're aware that we have a different position of what the disposition of that money should be. If I am correct in my assessment that that money is to go directly into the Constitutional Budget Reserve, then that argument is moot. Is that correct? Because not 6% of that would be going to mental health issues.
I think you're correct. Because it's not unrestricted. But I'm sure that, like my general opinion as to where the money goes, there would be those who would disagree. So, I think you're right.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you. Thank you for coming down, Charlie. I've been looking at this thing now for a couple of years here, and if we could just kind of maybe find out where we're at here. The state erred in taking the mental health lands that were set aside for the trust. They erred in disposing, they erred in encumbering, and they erred in designating many of those lands into special uses purposes that were no longer of value to the mental health trust. And those that are left and obviously could go back to the trust. Then the prior...
Let me say... Lest my silence be construed as agreeing with those remarks, I would prefer to say I have no comment with respect to whether the state breached all those obligations, but let us go on now.
I'm not, actually, I don't even know if this is true. I'm just trying to find out where we're at on this whole thing. When we,
but certainly those are the plaintiff's claims.
Yes. And I guess if I had was given 1 million acres and somebody bigger than me came in and took it away and did all these wonderful things to it, I would say that at least I was not treated fairly. So to correct this, in prior legislation, Chapter 66, we said, all right, we'll give you back those that are not encumbered, and we'll let you select comparable lands from a massive pool of other lands that will benefit you. And then, of course, I think to your credit, you've tried to release those mom and pops who are really the innocent victims in the whole thing here. The rest of them are probably, or something can be done with those, but the moms and pops are, they have no suggestion of how they can solve that. So when we got together and tried to decide, well, shall we try to put something together to force people to look at an alternative to trying to solve the reconstitution issue, which we were told at any rate, and I don't even know if this is true or not, but we were told that the reconstitution would very likely take years, and that it would essentially hold in hostage
those people who had placed great expenses to develop, say, encumbered land, the encumbered lands and things of this nature. And I know how these things work because I've been around here long enough to know that anytime you have a major thing brewing like this, everybody's going to try to, you know, position themselves to get the most out of it, including attorneys who are very happy to not choose. Who are undoubtedly...
I think I'm getting the least out of it.
Well, you know, I was just thinking that that I could probably go to college and get a law degree and still have a lifetime job if we keep going with this thing, even at my advanced age. So what this subcommittee did at any rate, we said, well, what can we do? We thought, well, maybe we can, Representative James had suggested that, well, instead of giving some percentage of the general fund for, you know, ad infinitum to create an income stream of that nature to entice people to give up the lands in lieu of the money, perhaps we should go back and put a lease mechanism on all the lands we have, all the parks and everything else, and then lease it. And then when we stop leasing it, then they obviously get the park lands, you know? And so we're absolutely stymied as to how to get this thing done. And we run the 3% out because we thought the 6% was, you know, was pie in the sky. I don't think anybody had any strong justification for that. The 3% we felt was at least in some consideration for the perhaps billions of dollars that the state has already paid out to the trust if you look at it on a quid pro quo. And so we thought, well, the 3% is, maybe that's realistic. And if it isn't, at least it puts something on the table to force people to try to justify some alternative. But we've been told, and I need to know whether you think this is true or not, that the current court impasse or difficulty in trying to develop the lands reconstitution, do you honestly feel as though that mechanism will produce a final settlement that will be satisfactory to all the claimants and the state of Alaska?
I would be less than candid if I did not make two comments in response to that question. One is that I personally have been disappointed in the way that the settlement agreement has functioned. Somewhat more particularly with respect to land selections by the claimants. Secondly, I've been disappointed by the inability to receive adjudications on these issues by the courts. End comment.
Okay.
Is there someone?
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Cole?
Yes, sir.
Is there someone else in your office that that can answer questions if we need?
Mr. Custer is here, and he's perhaps more qualified than I do to answer questions on the subject.
Okay, I'm sure we'll have more, and what we'll do at this time is go on to another. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, we will go to Mr. Bob Stiles, President of Alaska Coal Association. I've asked Mr. Stiles to give us a brief summary of House Bill 201 and what is proposed in it. Yeah, using the mic, yes.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Stiles. I'm the president of the Alaska Coal Association. I'm in business for myself here in the state of Alaska. I manage some properties in the Beluga coal fields, all of which are situated on original trust lands. I'll ask you to bear with me a little bit this morning. I'm not an attorney, and I will attempt to work my way through the bill. I'll put more of a businessman's perspective on it in terms of what I think it does, and if there are specific legal questions, I'll make a shot at them, but again, I'm not an attorney, so it isn't legal advice. I think the most important is to recognize what the concept of this bill is. It's an attempt to fix the major sticking points on Chapter 66. So to that extent, it's a set of amendments or modifications to Chapter 66. And clearly, the biggest sticking point on Chapter 66 was the whole land exchange process, particularly as it relates to replacement lands. This bill removes that as a sticking point. Now, having said that, there are also some what I classify as technical fixes in this bill, technical fixes for Chapter 66. And if it's your pleasure, I'll go through each section and kind of describe what I see these sections doing and the rationale for the particular sections. Section 1 of House Bill 201 is exactly what I described earlier, and that's a technical fix. The Alaska court system requested that the jurisdiction of the of this case go first to the Superior Court as opposed to the Supreme Court. In Chapter 66, it goes to the Supreme Court first. So Section 1 and, in fact, Section 9 adjust that jurisdiction to the first to the Superior Court, and that's as a result of a request of the Alaska court system. Section 2 of this bill is, to a large extent, identical to 66, the exception being paragraph 4, where it strengthens the language with regard to Department of Natural Resources management of the land assets of the trust. And it draws a parallel, if you will, to paragraph 5, where the Alaska Permanent Fund is the manager of the cash assets. So it just parallels those two management functions. Section 3 of House Bill 201 is, we have an amendment, a revision that we would like to submit to the committee, which will effectively remove Section 3. Not effectively, it will remove Section 3. The problem with Section 3 in this particular bill is that it allocates the income from the land to the trust fund. That's, we believe, to be in violation of the Enabling Act, where the income from the land has to go to the trust income account, which is the way that it is structured in Chapter 66. So an amendment that we will submit today will remove Section 3 in its entirety. Section 4 completely takes out, effectively takes out, the contentious part of Chapter 66, and that's the land exchange, substitute lands. And it, yes, sir?
1 minute, just for the, there is a copy of this in your folders that he's talking about.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chenoweth's analysis? Oh, I'm, oh, you mean the...
You're all right.
Okay.
Just trying to help us.
Well, in his legaling stuff, I need some help. I'm a rocket scientist by training, so...
with a minor in brain surgery.
Yeah, exactly. Section 4, though, effectively eliminates the... It does not necessarily, it repeals a section, part of the sections with land exchange as a subsequent sections in this, but it replaces it with an income stream, an allocation, if you will, not an appropriation, of a percentage of the unrestricted general revenues of the state to the trust income account. Section 5 establishes security for the state carrying through with the allocation of the income. And it's important to remember that this is an allocation of income, it's not an appropriation. And effectively what Section 5 does is establish security for the state honoring the allocation of the income. So, effectively, Section 4 is rent on those lands that don't go back to the trust. I don't know if that works totally in all the legal terms, but that's effectively the way it works. Section 6, these notes were written rather late last night, so I'm not sure glasses even help in reading them. Section 6 reconstitutes the land corpus of the trust from original trust lands that are not in LDAs, that are not muni lands, and that are not moms and pops. It only puts back into the trust unencumbered lands, original trust lands, and encumbered lands with the encumbrances listed here. Let me back up just a minute. On Section 5, there's an amendment also that you should have in your package that lifts some what otherwise might have been restrictions on the state's functioning on LDAs, the security, and basically says that the state can continue to allow and permit those, anything on the LDAs that's permitted by law, so that there's no restriction on the use of the LDA lands because they're held as, because they're security for the deal. Mm-hmm. That's particularly important in the case of some of the LDA lands. In the way that the Section 5 was originally written, it's conceivable that the state couldn't put a park bench in one of those parks. Equally important, at least from my industry's perspective, is that the Wishbone Hill mine is inside of an LDA. So it was questionable whether or not, there was some question about the ability of that project to go forward if that land were being held as security. The amendment that we have before you there will fix that. In Section 6, as I said, it reconstitutes the land corpus of the trust. The way that it is written here is that it's only a recognition of the existence of the mental health trust lands. That is a situation that it is generally unacceptable to the plaintiffs in that they're interested in having a patent to the lands so that they physically hold the patent, the trust authority would. So that section will take some amendments. We are working on those amendments and hope to have them to this committee next week. that will set out the situation where these would go to the trust authority subject to existing encumbrances and set some land management standards as it applies to those lands that are reconstituted in the trust. Section 7 only repeals, eliminates the repeal of Section 3805-800. And the reason for that is that the preceding section is, in fact, Section 3805-800. So in 66, that section was repealed. We've unrepealed it. I'm not sure that that's exactly the proper terminology either, but that's what's happened. Section 8 is a repealer section and basically takes out all of the land portion of 66. Sections 54 through 57 all spoke to reconstitution of the land corpus of the trust. Those sections are replaced in their entirety by parts of this particular bill. Section 9, as I mentioned earlier, is a jurisdictional one where it moves the jurisdiction from the Supreme Court to the Superior Court. And then Section 10 is certainly this committee's section and establishes the interface between this set of this bill and Chapter 66. It's in the work that we had done on the bill, it was something that slipped through the crack, I think, on our end, and we certainly appreciate the committee's pointing that up, and it'd be our intention to suggest that the companion Senate bill, Senate Bill 67, add this language. There's a hearing on that this afternoon. And I think with that kind of covers the bill analysis, at least from my perspective, and I hope that I haven't wandered into some legal areas where maybe I shouldn't be, not that I wouldn't have some business in those areas. I'll be more than happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I thought that was very informative, listening to the layman.
You understand that you said it.
Does anyone have any questions? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, is it my understanding that you are in support of this only with the amendments that you have suggested, or, I mean, are those more of a friendly nature? You like the bill, but you'd like to shore it up a little bit more.
Yes, that's okay. The amendments, let me be very clear in that we are very, very much in support of this bill. There are some things that we're constantly, we take some exception to the sign that's been posted outside where it identifies the Unholy Alliance. We had thought that, as I mentioned before, we're a member of a kind of a coalition that includes the public interest interveners and the oil interveners and the non-settling plaintiffs and development interest and that sort of thing, and we really considered that an unholy alliance. And we're working on a very regular basis and putting this thing together so that when the bill comes out, you can never make anything totally bulletproof from subsequent litigation. But the best chance that you've got is to have all the parties at the table that have some vested interest in it that might get involved in the litigation. And that's what this, quote, unholy alliance is. And so we're working our way through these individual pieces and hope to have some other somewhat technical amendments, although the amendments to 38 to Section 6, I think, are certainly within the purview and should be reviewed by this committee, and we will have those to you early next week. That's a long answer.
No, it's a good
long
answer.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative James.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Stiles, for being here today, and you did a fine job. I want to compliment you on that. But as you're talking, and especially when you bring up the Unfold the Alliance, there's a question that I would like to ask, because this whole mental health lens issue has been such a total frustration to me, and I have taken on a lot of personal time to try to understand it before I ever got to Juneau. But it seems to me like that there's two real points here that are being pushed, and the problem is those two points haven't been able to get together. One is whether or not the state messed up in the first place and that there are people who are denied because of that. And the other side of the issue is what's best for the state to get on with our business. What do we need to have? My problem with that is that it seems to be the state of Alaska on one side, and it is all the plaintiffs and all the interveners on the other side. And I might suggest that the Unholy Alliance would be better suited if the interveners could get on the part of the state so we could get on with our business. And I'm just wondering what your response would be to that, because what we certainly want to do is put this thing to rest and get on with the rest of our lives. And do you not think that's the interest of the state?
I think it's absolutely in the interest of the state to do that. And but you know, in order to establish a team, everybody's got to want to be on the team and want to play. We have not necessarily found that to be the case with regard to the Attorney General. We certainly would offer any opportunity to sit down and talk with the Attorney General, and would certainly ask that he join the Unholy Alliance, or we'd be more than happy to join whatever alliance that he might have put together.
Just as a follow-up, an analogy. We have a tug of war going here. Okay, and all of a sudden the playing field is sort of equal, and all of a sudden a whole bunch of people get over on this side. There's two actions that the person on the other could side, and dig in their feet and pull harder, or they could succumb. And so wouldn't you think it would be better if we could get somebody on both sides so that we could have a more even tug of war to enable us to get to what we all want, and that's to get on with our life?
I'm not sure I... are you suggesting... Let me see if I can understand the question a little more. Are you suggesting that some folks from, quote, the Unholy Alliance go over and pull on the end of the rope with the Attorney General?
I suggest that when that happens, that some of the focus of this whole fight will be changed. Think about it. You don't have to answer.
Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you. Bob, as I was mentioning earlier, everybody has something they want out of this. And coal obviously must be locked in irons in some form in order to enter this fray on either side of it. You've heard, of course, the Chapter 66 effort would try to reconstitute all these other lands so that they can free you up. And that's what you want, is to be freed up. I don't believe that you, while you may individually have some sort of an emotional issue with the mental health needs and things of this nature, I think it's fair to say that coal and some of the other encumbered lands, lessees and investors are most interested in freeing up their ability to go ahead and do what they've already invested in, and that is to mine the coal and things of this nature. So the issue then for you must be that in its present form, you're unable to do something. Can you tell me what you're unable to do at the present time that requires you to take a side on this issue?
Yes, sir. In just briefly, coal in particular is more market-driven than any of the other resources that we see in the state. And by that I mean that our customers look very strongly at the at your ability to have access to the land before they'll even talk to you with regard to buying something from you, because they're all long-term contracts. So you're actually in business with your customer. And while it's technically conceivable that we could go forward with a development by working our way through the process, if you will, that's set up under Chapter 66, the practical reality is we can't sell the coal because the customers, the perception that's created in the marketplace is that there's a land freeze, and we have no idea what the outcome, how that thing will finally shake out and when it will finally shake out. So we are held hostage, if you will, by the litigation. And it's not our fault. We are very much like the moms and pops in that respect. And then we entered into a contract with the state in good faith, took leases, invested substantial amounts of money based on a belief that we'd be able to mine the coal and, more importantly, sell the coal. And we can't sell it now because the customers aren't willing to take the risk associated with not being at some point in time your economics changing so drastically that you're out of business. The coal interests in general end up in exactly the same place under 66, under House Bill 201 and SB 67, are under a strict reconstitution. In our case, we are on original trust lands, so under any set of circumstances that you can conceive of, we're going to have a new landlord. But the problem is that we don't have that new landlord yet. We don't know who that landlord is, and more importantly, our markets don't know who that landlord is, and so we can't sell the coal.
If I might follow, then I'm trying to figure out if, you know, why it's not possible to do three quarters of the problem, which would free up those lands that you're involved in, as well as the moms and pops and things like that. Apparently the courts are calling for a total settlement or no settlements, and so that appears to be maybe to some extent Charlie's justification for saying that that he has some concern with the way in which the courts have behaved here. It seems to me, as you just said, that coal and other minerals and other people who've got investment in land, perhaps even oil development, things of this nature, are going to be dealing with mental health people. I mean, ultimately, that's what's going to happen there. And I'm just, I wish somebody could tell me why that couldn't happen now and leave the last piece of the action, which would be whether or not there's going to be a land swap for those lands that have already been sold or, you know, or otherwise disposed of, either through a land swap or through a money for land swap, and free up the other ones. But I guess we'd have to have somebody from the courts tell us that. Have they said that in any of the justifications as to why they wouldn't agree to all of these natural elements that should happen? Return the lands, do that, set up the trust, do that, transfer the obligated or the, you know, the encumbered lands to the trust, do that, and then go ahead and fight out a solution on either the land swap or the money for land.
Well, there, that has been, doing it on a piecemeal fashion has basically been challenged both by the state and by the plaintiffs, and so it's all lumped together. What we think this bill does, as 67 does, is that it removes all of the, it removes this big problem with the substitute lands, because what we're faced with right now under 66 is we're faced with 1956 all over again, and where they basically, the representatives of the trust get to select land with a whole lot more known about it than it was originally selected in 1956. Now, having said that, it's also the land that they got in 56, and a lot of it's not along and no longer available, and so you get into all kinds of problems about evaluations and everything else. Mm-hmm. And what this one does is it takes all of that problem away. It says, okay, here's what's left. You get that back. You take it subject to existing encumbrances. You're down the road. And that it's our opinion, and again, not a legal opinion, but it's our opinion that with the enactment of a bill along the lines of 201 SB 67, that we could be out of this mess by the fall. I don't know if that answered your question, but
it does, and that's obviously why the subcommittee came in with this proposal, because we saw the horribleness of the continuation of trying to figure out which lands are available and which ones are wanted and what their values are, and coming up with a reconstituted value for value situation. So this is our feeble efforts to try to break that impasse.
Well, we certainly appreciate it from our perspective, and offer to work with the committee in any way that we can to see this move along.
Representative Green. If I may, and please jump in and pounce on me if this is wrong, but I think one of the concerns that I would have if I were on the other side, if I were putting up money, would be that if this little piece of this full settlement were done, and now I can go ahead and invest, and unfortunately it's a large investment, whether it's oil or coal or whatever, and we're going down the road and all of a sudden the whole picture doesn't come together. And so the court comes back and says, okay, that's all off now, and unfortunately I've got my money invested and now I'm frozen out. And I think that's one of the big concerns, not only with, as you've said, not only with the investor, but with the market that's going to buy from that investor. And so I think the ripple effect is just untenable until the whole thing's settled.
I'd certainly support that, Representative Green, and I think that's the bottom line in the recent Supreme Court's denial of the petition. And believe me, I'm on shaky ground here, because this is really an illegal area. But what the Superior Court said when they denied the motion for lifting of the less pendants on the moms and pops was that it would be a cruel hoax to do that, because the plaintiffs in the settlement agreement maintained their right to reassert the claim to the future date in case 66 went down the tubes. So what would happen to you conceivably, I mean, and that was an attempt to solve a piece and to get some relief. A valid attempt, an applaudable attempt, but the ability to reassert those claims, it just sort of moved the cloud into a different file drawer for a while, but the cloud was still there. So, and I think on a piecemeal solution, as you've said, Representative Green, that's the kind of situation that we'd see if we went to any of the other pieces too. I don't like it very much, but I'm afraid that's the reality of it.
Okay. Do we have any more comments or questions for Mr. Stiles? If not, I'm sure we'll hear from you again. We will be dealing with this issue probably next week again. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
You might tell us when would be a good time for your schedule also, if you'd like.
I'm my schedule is at your pleasure, gentlemen. And
thank you. Next we'll hear from Jeff Jesse, attorney for the Advocacy Service of Alaska, one of the mental health groups which has withdrawn from the settlement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the senior attorney with Advocacy Services. As I stated in the Senate last week, one thing that's really kind of a shame is that the Attorney General is so busy and has so many issues to deal with that he's not able to finish listening to the rest of the hearings, because I think he'd learn quite a bit by sitting through and listening to what other people have to say about what's going on. It's really hard to know where to start with some of this. I guess one place to start is I know the Attorney General has a very strong feeling that there isn't a trust here. He's made it real clear he doesn't agree with what the courts have said in response to Representative Hudson's comments about that the state had a trust responsibility, the state breached that trust responsibility. Well, the Attorney General made it clear that he's not acquiescing in that vision of the situation. Well, this isn't just our claims. We aren't just alleging these things. The courts, the Alaska Supreme Court, has said this is a fact. You as trustees know that that is the case. And I think that this personal investment in refusing to recognize that in fact there has been a trust here and there has been a breach and there needs to be a fair settlement is one of the fundamental problems in getting everyone on the same side of the tug of war. To say that, well, someone ought to agree with Charlie that the Supreme Court was wrong and that there was no trust, well, that's going to help us get to a settlement? No, that's not going to help us get to a settlement. At some point, frankly, I think we need to say the emperor has no clothes here. This is an untenable position for the executive branch to continue to take, that there wasn't a trust, there was no breach, there's nothing here to be settled. That's not going to get us to a settlement. You know, I want to make one comment about this relief on the moms and pops. You know, you can kind of start to see these things coming. Okay, this is the reason maybe we're mulling over pulling out of the settlement. Okay, I heard that. I don't know if you heard that, but I heard, well, this is one reason we might jettison out of here. Well, I'll tell you, this relief to the moms and pops, and Mr. Stiles touched on it, was no relief. The court called it a cruel hoax. It was smoke and mirrors designed to try to make people feel good without really giving them any relief. I think it's time to be honest about what some of these things were and how the courts have interpreted them. Moving on to the bill and this concept of an income stream. Well, I certainly disagree with the Attorney General. The land was certainly designed to produce a stream of income to support the mental health program. Instead of using it for that purpose, the state has used it to fuel its own engine. It has used it for its own purposes to get the state moving in the direction that it thought it wanted to go in at the trust's expense. So I certainly think that just the concept of providing ongoing financial support for a mental health program is appropriate. We talk about the 6%. What's fascinating to me is to see how now the onus is on the plaintiffs to justify the 6%. Well, I remember, and some of you were here at the time, that the 6% wasn't our idea. You know, the legislature and the executive branch in 1991 tried to cram the 6% down our throats. You know, that was their idea of a fair settlement at the time. Now that we're trying to make that work, suddenly we are being outrageously greedy in suggesting that we continue to do what the legislature and the executive branch a few years ago thought was a great idea for how to settle this case. Well, I think we need to go back and re-examine how we got this 6% idea. This wasn't something that we created. It came from the legislature. One of the points I want to make about this income stream that I think gets missed, particularly when the Attorney General talks about how disproportionate this amount of money is to the claims involved. You know, we've talked about cashing this out. Okay, we couldn't agree on a valuation, but even if we could, if you cash this problem out, you're going to have to take money off the table and put it into a corpus account where it will be a separate revenue-generating entity. I mean, that's what a trust corpus is. Now, the percentage approach is different than that. It is not a percentage of income that is going to be taken off the table and put into some bank account somewhere. It is going to be used to supplant state general fund revenues, to supplant them, so that down the line there will be no more land, there will be no more corpus in the sense of it sitting there generating money. Okay, we are going, if this approach is successful, be using this income stream to supplant state general fund dollars. Now, why would the plaintiffs do this? Well, the reason that we would entertain this approach is because, okay, you don't want to give us the money. Every time we've talked about any valuation, people say, oh, wow, even $1 billion. I mean, we don't want to come up with $1 billion for this problem. You know? All right, people didn't want to put money into the trust. I understand that. It's tough financial times. We tried the land. The land deal isn't going to work, and I'll talk in a minute about just how badly it's not working. So this was an attempt to say, well, what do we want as plaintiffs and beneficiaries? We want some ability to benefit the beneficiaries. Does this seem like unreasonable? We want to try to help the beneficiary. One way to do that would be to say, fine, don't pay us in cash that we can put in the bank. Don't pay us with land that we'll have to manage. Give us some influence over how you spend the money you already spend for mental health. Because you know what? And this is no criticism of the people in the legislature, we can maybe do a better job. Now, why is that? Well, number one, we have the time, the energy, and the desire to focus on how to provide better mental health services for the dollars that are spent. I think all of you know that when appropriations are made and these programs out there that receive state funds, there is very little incentive for them to do better with the money they have. I know my own nonprofit corporation, if we save $10,000 in a fiscal year, we don't reap any benefit for that. I mean, that money goes back to the state does something else with it. That's why every agency, and you all know this, at the end of the fiscal year, you spend every dime you got. Somehow you obligate it. You know, whatever you can get away with obligating it, that's what you do. But you know, I just spent 2 days with the Mental Health Board working on their strategic plan for how to spend the 6%. I really wish this committee and every legislature could go and observe what happens to people when they think they have an investment in the money. Suddenly, they're really interested in how the 6% is spent. Because now a dollar saved, a dollar better spent, is another person served, is something better for the state and the beneficiaries. I think that people need to understand conceptually that we are giving up the land in this approach for influence over some money, not this huge amount of money that the Attorney General persists in saying is disproportionate to the risks of the state in litigation. Finally, how much is this deal not working? It is stunning to me that every time the state gets into a deal on the Mental Health Lands Trust and it decides it got into a bad deal, it reneges. Now, you've seen this before. It happened in Chapter 48. When they realized that that was a bad deal, they reneged. Well, now they're realizing that Chapter 66 is a bad deal. And you have in your packets two letters and a copy of a settlement, a page out of the settlement agreement, where what the state is essentially saying is they're not going to honor the settlement agreement. That they refuse to fulfill their obligations in the settlement agreement. Now that has forced the settling plaintiffs to write another letter, which you also have in your packet, saying, no, you can't get away with this. You cannot renege on the settlement that you made. You also have one page out of the settlement agreement. You know, I really appreciated Mr. Stiles up here talking about this, because I don't think you need to be an attorney to understand what's going on. You all look at that page out of the settlement agreement. You tell me what you think it says. I think it is crystal clear. I was there. I know what was intended. So now what are we going to do? We're going to litigate over what the settlement agreement meant so we can litigate to get the deal approved, so we can litigate over what lands we're going to get. I mean, we're starting to make this the most incredible debacle in the history of the state as far as I can tell. I mean, I think this is a very serious concern. I'm also concerned that we're trying to pin the blame here on the settling plaintiffs. Now, I certainly have some disagreements with them. That's why I got off the deal. All right? But one of the things I hear the Attorney General say regularly is, well, they picked Cook Inlet. Well, there weren't any oil and gas lands in the original trust land. Well, I have here a printout of original trust land that the consultants hired by the settling plaintiffs believe have significant oil and gas potential. Does this look like the original trust had no oil and gas lands in it? The state simply doesn't like their deal. Now, when we get to the Finance Committee, we'll talk about the percentage, but I think one way to look at the percentage is, look, if we're giving up this land for influence over the program, the way to look at it, in my view, is, well, what ought that program to be that we're getting influence over? What services? What appropriations? What's the scope of that program? That should drive where the influence is applied. And those are the things that we'll be talking about in finance. I think this is an appropriate direction to go. I certainly feel that we need to, when we get to finance, deal with some of the financial aspects of it. I applaud the committee being willing to take the step in here to move forward, to recognize that the land exchange portions of 66 will not work. But I think it's time to move on, and hopefully at some point the Attorney General and the Governor will realize that they've got to pull on our end of the rope, because we got to all be pulling together, or we're not going to get out of this problem. Thank you very much.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. You said some magic words in your presentation that I was very impressed with. And one of the things, and everyone seems to misunderstand my goals, which is to come to some common agreement. And that takes lots of negotiations, and a lot of negotiations is not happening on one side of the rope at this point in time. Okay, but what you said is what your main goal is, to be able to have some input into the mental health lands budgeting process. Okay, who are the we that you're talking about in that case?
That would be the beneficiaries and their representatives.
Okay, and how would that we work differently than what we have with the mental health trust board situation that we have? We have a mental health board. Isn't that what's making those budget decisions now?
No, the board doesn't make decisions whatsoever. The board makes recommendations which the legislature and the executive branch routinely ignore with no rationale, justification, or other sort of description of why their view of what needs to happen is so different from what the board recommends.
Okay, next question then is, it's my understanding that the funds that would be in the mental health trust would be appropriated for mental health expenditures by the legislature.
That is correct.
Okay. And if there is more money in there than they need, the legislature could take it out and appropriate it somewhere else.
That is correct.
Then if you were making up a budget, from we, the beneficiaries, that would represent the way you thought the money would be spent, and there wasn't enough, you might have to ask us for another appropriation.
From general funds, which you would not be obligated in any way under the trust to appropriate.
Then why can't we short circuit this entire process and put you in that position?
I'm sorry, I'm not clear.
Can't
what
we exchange the mental health board for the mental health beneficiaries?
Well, that's essentially what 66 and this approach would do, is instead of the mental health board, there'd be